You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 109. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife and conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Today's guest on the show is Dr. Francis Gulland, senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center and a member of the International Committee for the Recovery of the Vaquita. This committee is composed of the world's top vaquita experts, and they just released a new report which contains some shocking revelations. Before we jump into our interview with Francis, however, I'm going to check in with EOC producer Sean Bogle to get an update on our vaquita documentary project, Souls of the Vermilion Sea. We have a new half-hour film associated with this project that we are about to release, and Sean's here to explain the inspiration behind this new release, as well as our outreach goals moving forward with the project.
This film, although it seems to put a huge emphasis on vaquita, there is an equal amount of urgency on the people, the communities that are involved in this. And this means the fishing communities. That means the biologists that have been doing this since day one. So this issue has always been in their mind, and they've continued on. And all they've seen during their entire career is the population decline. And when you know this, and you have these one-on-one conversations with them, and you're inside their homes and you're sharing a meal with them, they really alter the way you feel, or I personally feel when I'm thinking about trying to tell the story. So I wanted to create a story that just wasn't a bunch of, and I may have said this several times before, but regurgitated headlines in the process of us doing the research. That's what I saw. So I didn't want to just keep repeating what was already going out there. And still to this day, the developments of what's happening with the vaquita is, it's the same stuff all over again. There's no personal connection. The media is really painting a picture of how the vaquita is going to go extinct. So this is more of sympathy or empathy for an animal. But you must realize that we all live on a planet where we need to coexist. And the choices that you make in conserving a species also affects the people that live in those same environments. And that is the component that's missing that the media is not touching on. And that's what our story is adding to. So it's in addition to, which makes it not only more comprehensive, but this is where the connection happens. This is where we're trying to make people realize and understand that we're not alone. And we want people to get in touch with realizing that, We can try to save all the species all we want to, but we have to do that together, and we have to understand why we are doing it.
We experienced this moment on this shoot in the spring of 2016, and I think, I mean, you kind of expressed that feeling that I felt like we had, which was we were feeling this sense of urgency within the community, right? And it wasn't just about the vaquita. A lot of it was about the vaquita, especially for us, but it wasn't just about the vaquita. It's about the Tatuaba. It's about the community. And it really felt like this community was going through a crisis. And part of that was because of vaquita, but it's not all of it. A huge part of it was this illegal trade in Tatuaba swim bladders and this increase in the illegal activity within the community. And, you know, we were seeing the influence of drug cartels that were smuggling the swim bladders and just hearing some really troubling stuff from the fishermen that we were interacting with down there. And I think, you know, that whole picture, you know, I think that inspired us to say essentially, like, we can't wait any longer. Like, we can't wait. You know, I feel like we were waiting. We were going down there and we were shooting and we were waiting for, like, something dramatic to happen that would sort of indicate to us that, oh, this is, like, this feels like a natural conclusion to the story, right? And now we can jump into post-production and start putting together our feature-length film, right? But I think we realized in that moment that, like, it might take years for that moment to happen, and we needed to express what we were seeing immediately, you know, because if we wait, you know, if we wait for this sort of moment that feels like a natural conclusion to the story, it's probably going to be too late for the Vaquita, certainly, and might be too late for the community as well. So, like, what happened next? I mean, you know, we sort of had this moment where we sort of, you know, made this important decision that we were going to jump in and start going through footage and try to piece something together. We kind of had this target length of maybe half hour in mind. Where do we go from there? I mean, what was that post-production process like, jumping into that? What was that like for you?
Honestly, it was no idea where to even start. We're really trying to figure out who our target audience would be, the people of Mexico, or more specifically, the fishing communities, people of the U.S. who are completely oblivious, for the most part, about this issue altogether, but yet do play a role in as far as where they get their seafood from, which is coming exactly from these fishing communities. And the other target audience, of course, are the people in mainland China, where these swim bladders are being smuggled and sold. And there are three different completely perspectives on what's happening. And a lot of it is the information is not there for any one of them in a nice, clean pot where you can just, you know, look at it and go, oh, these are all the ingredients. It's not like that. It's very fragmented. Everybody has a different feel on that. So when we identified, okay, these are the target audiences, we then had to, oh gosh, the story was, well, it was all over the place. Not sure exactly what components we had to tell. It seems to me that releasing the shorter versions, like the 13-minute cut and then now the 30-minute cut and whatever we release in the future, releasing these in such a way where the time span between them, that keeps the information relevant, but then also it will help us gauge exactly what our next step is, especially when we do these screenings that we have coming up in March in Mexico.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think you're right that balancing act that we have been playing between these different target groups who we want to reach and who we think it's most important to reach with this message contained within the film, they're very disparate, right? And so that was sort of I think our greatest challenge in piecing this thing together was, you know, creating a message that we could put out there that would resonate with both people in Hong Kong and people in mainland China, as well as people in these small fishing communities in the Upper Gulf in Mexico. So what's next? I mean, you talked a lot about sort of our thought process and how tricky it was to sort of formulate the story and make sure that it's something that folks in these fishing communities, which are the epicenter of this, you know, our story and this issue, that this would be something that would benefit them, that would sort of get them thinking about this issue. So what's next? You know, now that the film is just about complete, what are we doing with it? Where are we going with it?
We've shared the film with a variety of other groups that have been involved with this issue for quite a bit. And we've also shared it with groups that have jumped on the campaign later on, but are definitely pulling some serious weight and making some new headway. And now, in order to really make this film more acceptable, we are planning to go down to the Upper Gulf and the towns of San Felipe and Santa Clara and do some community screenings. And the goal behind that is to use this as an opportunity so that they can see the way that we have framed the story, and then for them to offer feedback as far as how the film makes them feel, and not just the fishermen, the communities themselves, because the businesses, the restaurants, everything has been impacted by this. And it's that feedback that will help us continue to tell this story, because we then know who that audience is. And that we would like to, of course, do this in China as well, but one step at a time. But that's essentially our goal. That will happen at the end of March. We'll go down there and do that. And then, you know, because we're there, we're going to continue filming, because it is essentially the height of the Tatuapa fishing period. And as much as I've been with the contacts we have down there, it's extremely rampant right now. There's no signs of letting up whatsoever.
That's an important point for us to make, and for, I guess, our audience to be aware of, is that, you know, we have just about completed this half hour cut of our film, which we feel is like a pretty, you know, I mean, it's not all inclusive, right? But we feel like it's the most comprehensive story out there that shows all these different aspects of the issue and what's going on with the Vaquita and the Tatuaba and these communities in the Upper Gulf. But this is not over, right? I mean, the issue is certainly not over, and our film is certainly not over. We are going to continue shooting for this. The goal remains to eventually put together a feature-length documentary about this, and I think the announcements that have come out over the past couple of months, I think, have really sort of shown us how important it is for us to continue to document what's going on with this issue. We now know that as of the end of 2016, there were only 30 Vaquitas left, which is a 50% decline from the previous year. The end of 2015, it was estimated there were 60. That's actually an increase in the rate of decline from previous years, which is shocking and scary. And, you know, as Sean, as you just said, I mean, we are in the height of this year's illegal Tatuaba fishing season. So right now, fishermen are going back out. So like when we say there's 30 Vaquita left, we mean as of the end of 2016, before the height of the illegal Tatuaba season began. But now that illegal Tatuaba fishing season has begun, fishermen are going out, putting illegal gill nets in the water. So who knows how many, I mean, we really don't know. We're once again in this situation, right, where we don't really know how many Vaquitas are left. Right, we know it's probably less than 30 at this point. But we're not going to know sort of what the true impact of this year's illegal Tatuaba fishing season is until the end of 2017, when we finally start to get those results in from the remote acoustic monitoring program.
I would like to mention, though, I mean, all this attention is going on the Vaquita, and it's important because we're down to very few numbers. But there hasn't been a report of Vaquita mortality in a while, since last spring. That's not to say that has not happened. I think that at this point, people are not going to want to report that. So if they catch a Vaquita in their net, they're probably going to sink it. What is obvious, and this is where you pretty much can do simple math, is that there have been countless reports of other marine mammals getting caught in these nets. We're talking adult whales, gray whales, humpback whales, dolphins, sharks, rays. I just saw a report today, another dead dolphin, same thing. It's got gill net marks on it. Everyone needs to realize that whatever happens to the Vaquita, there are other species out there that are also declining. It just happens so that they are not on the cusp of extinction, but they're headed that way.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. There hasn't been a recovery of a dead Vaquita since last spring, March of 2016, when we were down in Mexico immediately after those reports of those three dead Vaquitas that were found. And that was like big news. I mean, that was international news when Sea Shepherd and those other folks, you know, found those Vaquita carcasses. And almost certainly at this point, because of what happened in the spring of last year with all of the press that those Vaquita recoveries got, that fishermen are not, if they do pull up their net and there's a dead Vaquita in that net, they're going to make sure that nobody else can find that carcass. I think you can say that with a pretty high degree of certainty, right? And even last year in spring of 2016, while we were down there, we were hearing rumors about additional Vaquita carcasses that had turned up that local fishermen had hidden.
Yes, that's
so
great.
I think that was already happening last year. And I think, yeah, I mean, this year we're probably not going to get any of those reports of, you know, Vaquita, dead Vaquitas, you know, washing up on the beach or being found by the Sea Shepherd boat, because almost certainly the fishermen who pull up those dead animals are going to be hiding those carcasses. So we've painted this very dire picture, which we always sort of seem to do whenever we have these discussions about the Vaquita. Of course, the experts and the researchers who are studying the Vaquita have essentially at this point come together and said that they are going to attempt to bring Vaquita into a captive setting. They're going to attempt to live trap Vaquita set up some form of sea pen that they can place those animals in just to protect them and keep them safe, because it's obviously not a safe environment just out in the open water in the upper Gulf of California right now. So we're not going to delve into that topic in depth, because Sean, you actually recorded an interview with Dr. Francis Gulland, who is on that committee, the International Committee for the Recovery of the Vaquita.
So yes, I reached out to Francis Gulland, who is the senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center, and I simply reached out to her to get an update on what it is exactly that this announcement of vaquita captures is all about. And honestly, I'll just let Francis do most of the talking, as this is, it's still in development, and we're just staying really close to this because obviously we are striving to get on that vessel so that we can continue documenting, because this is another component of the story that we did not foresee. So yeah, no, listen to Francis. Francis will explain it quite well. Hello and welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast. And on today's show, we have Dr. Francis Gulland, senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Francis, we've spoken before at the very beginning of our project when we launched our Souls of the Vermilion Sea film project, which is about the struggle to save the vaquita from extinction. And although people are familiar with some of your background, could you just give us a brief summary and overview of exactly what your occupation is and what you do? And, well, you know, are there any other hats that you wear besides being the senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center?
Certainly. I'm a veterinarian by training, so my initial involvement with the vaquita was necropsy work and diagnosing causes of death in animals that were recovered dead. But I also serve currently as commissioner to the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission. And the Marine Mammal Commission in the U.S. is an oversight agency for the federal government that its mission is to ensure the conservation of marine mammals. And our jurisdiction is obviously U.S. waters, but we also have a role in international conservation of marine mammals.
Because we've just recently transferred power and we're on a new administration, are you still involved in that at this point?
Certainly. The commission is still a federal agency, and the commissioners are appointed by the president and by the White House and Senate confirmed. So we serve until replaced. So I was appointed by President Obama, and I've honored to serve him, and will continue to serve the commission until replaced.
That's a very big responsibility, and I know that there's a whole wonderful team of people that are also a part of that. So I, whatever the outcome may be, I hope it's a positive one. So you have been involved previously in the recovery of species before. Could you tell us a little bit more about your experience as far as, like, you know, what species those were and what the outcome was?
Well, our main work here at the Marine Mammal Center has been with the Hawaiian monk seal as far as endangered species, and that's because of our strong background in pinniped care, rehabilitation, and release. So we built a monk seal hospital in Hawaii where we rehabilitate malnourished or orphaned monk seal pups and then release them back to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. And that also has an outreach and education program attached to it. So that's probably our biggest current program here at the center for endangered marine mammals. With the commission, we're involved in a whole suite of projects and programs for endangered species worldwide. In fact, we've just returned from a trip to the Mekong River in Cambodia, where the commission's been supporting conservation efforts for the Irrawaddy River dolphin on the Mekong. So that is a population that is threatened by bycatch and gill nets, very similar to the vaquita in the upper Gulf of Mexico.
Just briefly, the monk seal, as far as, you know, what drove involvement to recover the species? I mean, was it also on the threshold of extinction? And where does it stand now? What sort of effort had to be put in place in order to, you know, are they stable?
So the monk seal population has been declining for about 20 years. And the population was, about 1,000 animals, but they're hovering at about 1,200, 1,100, but a steady, consistent decline of the past 20 years. And over the past 5 years, there's been a huge amount of investment from National Marine Fisheries Service, from various NGOs on the Hawaiian Islands, and from us at the Remyamal Centre, to really enact a suite of conservation actions. Some of it has been outreach to people living on the main Hawaiian Islands, because monk seals have now moved into the main Hawaiian Islands and they're a significant part of the population. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of work with fishermen to use circle hooks instead of hooks that are barbed that can damage monk seals' throat if they eat them. There's been work to remove marine debris from the northwest Hawaiian Islands. And then the Remyamal Center's role has been to rehabilitate young and malnourished juveniles, so to enhance their survival so they can basically grow up and contribute to the adult breeding population. So we opened our hospital 3 years ago, and we've now released 15 monk seals, and we have 4 currently in rehabilitation, and that's about 1% of the current population. So in fact, this year, National Marine Fisheries Service has announced the official year of the monk seal, and it's the first time that the population has not declined in the last few decades. So we're very excited that perhaps this is a time of turnaround, and that we are seeing, if not yet full recovery, at least we're seeing no further decline this year.
So essentially it kind of plateaued, at least for the moment. It's on the teeter.
I mean, it's, you could really say that when you're looking at 50 years worth of data. Mm-hmm. But we can say that last year's census did not show a further decline compared to the year before and the year before that. So numbers are stable right now. We hope that that continues and that the population starts to really recover and build up.
So with everything that you've been doing with the Hawaiian monk seal, what made you all of a sudden decide to jump on this vaquita campaign? Like, at what point did you learn about the vaquita and actually start becoming involved with the vaquita and then the issues that face mm-hmm. its survival?
Well, I've been aware of this fate of the vaquita, or the status and the concern over mortality, for 20 years, I think. When I first came to the US, I assisted in a workshop to train students in necropsy techniques in Baja, and the main species we used for the necropsy workshop was vaquita carcasses that had been bycaught in gillnets. So we had 4 carcasses then for a workshop, and even then the population was in decline. So here we are 20 years later, where the problem is much more acute. And I joined Server about three years ago, really through my role as the commission and also as a vet, concerned about mortality.
And just for our audience, can you please tell us what Server is?
Server is the international recovery team for the vaquita, the Comité Internacional para Recuperación de la Vaquita.
Oh, very nice. Are you fluent in Spanish with all the time that you spent down there?
I'm not fluent, but I can understand. I can get by.
I actually never knew that you had this experience prior to all this. I thought you just got involved. I had no idea that you actually were conducting necropsies on carcasses. Back then, was there anything, what exactly was being done? Were they just accepting these carcasses on the beach? I mean,
there's always been, there's been continual work. Really, Lorenzo Rojas's group have been working with fishermen for years on alternative gear techniques, on reducing basically any attempt to reduce gillnet bycatch. There just hadn't been a gillnet ban by the federal government until recently. Hmm. But there's been a lot of work in the community.
Coming from that point in your life to where we are now, I mean, it's radically different. And the fact that you've, much like, I've had many conversations with Lorenzo and Barbara Taylor. And at this point, when the people, the general public, are now receiving this information, they're seeing a very small pocket of window of what's happening and what has happened. But for someone who has seen it just kind of play out, I mean, it has to be unsettling on many levels, and almost have a sense of helplessness. So how do you actually initiate and then sustain your involvement with trying to save a species from extinction? I mean, do you have a sense of hope? at the very beginning, and then, you know, where we are now, like, does it seem like the...
I think you'll always have to have hope. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning and do the work that we do. So I think everyone working in conservation always has hope, and you have to have hope to keep going. But often times are hard, and often projects don't work, and often some of the challenges are still there every day. But I think if we didn't get up and have hope, we wouldn't keep fighting the good fight, as we say.
Right, right. Well, you're absolutely right on that. That's essentially why we're even making the film. Otherwise, if it seemed like a lost cause, I guess it would have been completed a while ago. You know, I was at the Service 7 meeting last year in Ensenada, Mexico, and that was actually the first time that the environmental minister had ever attended any CERVA meeting. Mm-hmm. And the announcement of the vaquita population during that time was 60 mm-hmm. individuals remaining.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the new numbers for 2016
mm-hmm.
Have been announced by CERVA, the population has been cut in half to 30 mm-hmm. individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been filming for 2 years now,
mm-hmm.
and we've been down there, and we've seen a variety of efforts, from outreach to military to advocacy to, you know, the fishermen being, you know, trying to be a part of the solution. Of course, there's still a lot of legal fishing going on. Are we doing enough? I mean, if the population has been cut in half, and, you know, I personally have witnessed that there is something being done, mm-hmm. but it just doesn't seem to be enough. Where are we at this point? Like, I guess it's difficult for me to see this, because it seems like, okay, well, if you have all these people that are trying to save the vaquita, well, then at this point we should see either some sort of stabilization or a decline that's not so radical. But the fact that the population has been cut in half is, you know, that's got to raise a lot of questions. I mean, are we doing enough? And if not, what else should we be doing?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still illegal fishing going on. So clearly we aren't doing enough to stop illegal fishing. It's still happening. So there needs to be, you know, more enforcement of the gill net ban. You know, Mexican government has passed a gill net ban, and it's not being 100% enforced. So it doesn't matter if it's partially or you know, small percentage of illegal fishing. As long as there are gill nets in the water, vaquita will die in gill nets, and that's what's happening. So we need more enforcement, and we need to continue the sunken gill net removal program that was started last summer and has continued in the fall and will be picked up again this spring. And it continues to pull up sunken and active gill nets. So there are still gill nets in the water. It's really as simple as that. And as long as there are gill nets in the water, they will catch vaquita. So we need to do more to get those gill nets out and to prevent other gill nets being put in, which is basically enforcement and continual removal of gear.
Right. So this stuff needs to work in tandem, though. I mean, it's not one thing or the other. Like, they have to work together. So when mm-hmm. you say that there's you know, you need more enforcement, when you have, you know, 500 Army troops and another 600 Navy, and you have two helicopters, military helicopters, doing aerial surveys, and you have small planes doing surveys, and the presence of military and roadblocks rampant, like, how much more needs to be done? Like, how is that not enough enforcement? Like, where is the leak here? Because that's what it seems like to me.
Well, that isn't actually happening every day. If you go out in the water with Sea Shepherd, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, they're out there with their vessels, and I've visited a couple of times, and yes, all those assets in the Mexican Navy, they are around, but not 24 hours a day, every day, in the vaquita refuge. So there are times when there's no enforcement, and illegal fishermen know when those windows are.
Right. Yeah.
So yes, it's not enough.
right? I mean, I've been following the headlines coming out, and it seems like they're doing arrests every week.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just swim bladders being... And that's just the ones that they caught. Now, so with everything that we've said thus far now is... What are the next steps? I mean, knowing everything we do, like, what are we supposed to do now? I mean, just much of the same? Or are we now going to come up with something completely different in addition to everything else that we've been doing? Because mm-hmm. I feel like we're spinning our wheels here.
So the current main actions are to get sunken gill nets out of the water, so to continue to use grappling hooks and do transect lines through the Vaquita Refuge, and every time something is picked up on a grappling hook, pull that out of the water. So a continued effort to remove anything that could entangle a Vaquita in the water. Continue to work with the Mexican government on enforcement and prolonging the gill net ban, because that does expire in April. And then, because there's so few animals left, because the concern of extinction is really high now, one of the techniques that's been used in other critically endangered species is to temporarily remove those animals from the habitat if they can't be protected in the habitat, and simply protect them until their environment is safe again. So that really means catching Vaquita and placing them in a net pen or an above-ground pool where they can be protected from gill nets, and then as soon as that area is gill net free, so anything sunken has been removed and enforcement is 100%, then release them back to the wild. So there's a lot of effort going on right now from the international community that's familiar with handling and catching and housing cetaceans on developing a plan to do just that.
The idea of capturing Vaquita for potential captive breeding program.
But stop. Okay. So no one said captive breeding. There's a...
Okay.
There seems a very jump from people who hear about the effort to temporary house to captive breeding. That's a number of steps down the line. The first step is to catch animals and just place them in a sanctuary where they're protected from gill net bycatch. And ideally, protect them for a couple of years and release them again. So if they're in captivity for a long time in a sanctuary, then they would breed. But the aim right now is not captive breeding. The aim is temporary protection from gill nets.
Okay. Well, is that even possible?
Well, we don't know until we try.
I mean, has there been any other attempts with another porpoise in the past?
Yes, there's a very successful program right now for the Yangtze finless porpoise in China, where porpoises have been caught from the Yangtze River and translocated to oxbows in China. And those animals have not only survived the transport, but are breeding, and the population has increased to a level that they're now expanding the program into two further oxbows. So there is a history, actually, with porpoises in China that's been very successful.
That's amazing, but can we apply the same type of effort and expectations that the Vaquita, or is there a gray area or unknown with the Vaquita, because we don't know that much about the Vaquita?
Well, no one has caught and housed Vaquita before, so every species is different, and until you work with a species, you don't know how they'll respond. But there's a lot of work and a lot of experience from catching, tagging, housing harbor porpoises, finless porpoise. So the question really is, how will Vaquita respond to that type of handling?
Now, I assume that this this idea to locate and capture Vaquita is not taken lightly.
Mm-hmm.
There has been, it seems to be a very controversial issue. There's, mm-hmm. there's a lot of opposition mm-hmm. towards this.
Mm-hmm.
I recall at the server meeting, in your mm-hmm. conversation with Pacquiano, there was some mm-hmm. reluctance initially when he had mentioned, hey, why don't we just mm-hmm. corral them up, and it's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
So from that moment that you had this, you know, when he kind of pitched this idea
mm-hmm.
and you essentially had to explain, well, this is kind of what goes into it. We don't have enough information at this point. You know, mm-hmm. what was that threshold that all of a sudden, you know, this reluctance to like, no, we actually need to implement this and we need to do it relatively mm-hmm. soon.
Well, I think the reality is that the decline has continued. So over the last year, there's been a 50% decline. So that extreme decline, when you have a population under 100, means that they will be extinct in a couple of years if nothing different happens. So when you're really faced with extinction in the face, then you really have to look at all options that are out there for trying to save a species. And ex-situ conservation is one of those tools, and it's not being commonly used for marine mammals, and it's hard and challenging and controversial, but those aren't reasons for not trying if the alternative is extinction.
So what are the risks involved?
The risks are animals being stressed by handling. So an animal could easily die when handled. Animals could get entangled in nets. So there's risks to each individual animal when you handle them.
Okay, and just with what you said, that's still worth the you know, to follow through with this, even though there's the potential to contribute to...
Well, you can do the math. If you handle an animal and you kill one, then you've killed one animal. And then you can stop and reassess your program. Mm-hmm. Currently not doing this, in the last year, 30 animals have died.
I mean, are you hearing any negative feedback from other people about
yes,
approaching
people.
This?
Absolutely.
Animal rights groups? Or, I mean, I don't really know who knows about it at this point.
I think we know from the California condor example that there was a huge amount of controversy about bringing condors, capturing or removing eggs of condors, of captive breeding condors, and not everyone agrees to this day whether that was the right thing to do or not. The facts are that condors still exist, and the population's breeding in the wild, and they soon will also be flying over the hills of Oregon. So I think if it had not been for that program, we wouldn't have condors today. And there are many examples of species that exist now because of captive breeding programs, such as the Arabian oryx, Przewalski horse, Mexican red wolf. So, you know, it is a tool that can be successful. We don't know how well it will work for vaquita, and we won't until we try. But we do know that there's currently a 50% decline, so they, if nothing else changes, they will be extinct by 2020. So we need to continue, as I said earlier, with the gillnet ban. We need to increase enforcement. We need to remove sunken gillnets. But we should also consider temporary protection in a sanctuary if none of those are working.
One of the other things I would be curious to know is, What does this capture effort look like? Like what sort of planning has to go into this, and what sort of team needs to oversee it, like, as far as putting them together as experience to get the best outcome they possibly can?
Sure. So the team is really international experts who have worked with other cetaceans before. So currently there is a group of people that... have experience in capturing, in housing, in feeding and in veterinary care of a range of small cetaceans. So that's the current effort, is to really harness the world's best that could make this successful.
And the, you know, do you guys already have the plan already set in motion as far as like what you have to do, and when is it going to happen? As far as
those are all moving targets at this point.
Okay, yeah. But is there an ideal time to do it? I mean, obviously the height of the Tetuaba illegal fishing is going to happen
mm-hmm.
March, April.
Yeah. Well, this is a lot of these questions are we don't know the answers to yet. I mean, this is, you know, I'm an American. I'm sitting in California, so we're talking about a capture effort, a sanctuary in Mexico. So this would be a Mexican sanctuary in Mexican waters, run by Mexican people for Mexican animals. So many of these questions, we can give advice, and we can develop a plan, and we can bring experts from Europe and China to the table, but ultimately the plan has to be led by Mexico.
So the vaquita, if any were to be captured, would reside in their environment, just in in an enclosed safety.
Yeah.
And also in San Felipe or Santa Clara or something like this.
That would be the ideal.
Ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there has been an announcement that the U.S. Navy has now gotten involved per request of the Mexican Navy, and they are going to use trained dolphins, a part of their marine mammal program, to locate vaquita.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds very sci-fi for many people, just because you're using a marine mammal to locate another marine mammal in hopes to locate so that they can capture. That's essentially the premise. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what is that process as far? Do you know much about exactly what that looks like? I mean, how does a dolphin locate a vaquita? And you know, the other thing that comes to mind is, with all the nets, are there any concerns that the dolphins are going to get entangled in these nets, especially with there's so many of them around?
So the Navy's mammal program has, I mean, it's been running for years, and the dolphins are trained to recover sunken objects. They've been very successful at, they've been doing a humanitarian exercise in the Mediterranean, removing recognizing and detecting unexploded ordnance that then has been recovered by divers. So that is what they're trained to do, is to identify objects. And in this case, there would be vaquita rather than a mine or a military object that needs to be recovered. So I don't train dolphins. I just know that they have a very successful program and that they've offered to assist. So the issue right now is that vaquita are so rare, they're very hard to see. And you obviously know that from trying to film them. So any way that we can enhance our ability to find them is great. So if the dolphins can find them when we can't, that's it's another tool to help us find vaquita.
It's quite an amazing idea, really. So what is ideal as far as how many vaquita? You know, I understand that we don't know if we're going to catch any, you know, if any are going to get caught at all.
Mm-hmm.
But what is ideal? And then also, is there, you know, there's obviously have to keep in mind male and female, especially if you're considering, reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So what is ideal, and what do you think is likely?
The current plan that's being developed is a stepwise approach to reduce risk to individuals. So at each step of the way, the program would be assessed by an external review panel with the aim of, you know, assessing what's happening in the environment, what's happening with the gill net removal, and how the individual vaquita has responded to capture and handling and housing. So there's a whole series of steps, and every single step would be reviewed, and a decision will be made whether to continue to the next step. So if you're going to be risk averse, the first step is to catch one and simply see how that animal responds. So that's the ideal for the first step is one. And then if that goes well, two. And if that goes well, three. You know, but at every point you have to assess what's happening in the field, what's happening with the gill nets removal, what's happening to the rest of the population, and then how the animals responding to capture and housing. So it's a moving target and really an adaptive management approach.
So when I think about the potential for some sort of disaster, vaquita, you know, dying in this process, surely that's a heavy weight to bear on those involved. I mean, how would that, how does that affect you personally, just knowing that even exists? You know, it's, you'd be waiting, you know, in anticipation.
So I'm a veterinarian. Every time I work with an animal, there's a risk of it dying. I mean, if you handle a wild animal, you have to decide whether the risk is warranted. So you have to decide, am I handling this animal? Why am I handling this animal? Is it, you know, does it have a disease that's incurable? Can I intervene and in some way save it? And that's a decision you make every time you handle an animal. So currently for me, if I handled a vaquita and it died, of course it would be extremely upsetting. But if we don't try and handle them, just in the last year, 30 animals have died. So it's a question of a risk to an individual, but trying to save some of the population for the future and for future generations.
What would you say to the people out there that are either extremely emotional about this or on the fence because they don't quite have all the facts or understanding?
Well, so currently the population is declining, and there are, you know, last year there were 60 animals, and they are declining. The population is going down. It's gone down 50% over the last year. So I think most people can go 60, 30, 15, 7, 3, you know, 1.5, 0. So that means that we're looking at extinction over, you know, the next 5 years. So something has to change. So we either we need to get rid of all the gill nets in the water, we need to increase enforcement, and then we need to protect every individual that's left. And we just have to think of every way that we can do that. So currently, if people want to know more, the Viva Vaquita website has a lot of information and have discussed the pros and cons of ex situ. The Mriemel Center's website has most of the reports from server and other documents that really describe what's happening by different organizations. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has an excellent website and Facebook, and they are very active on the water right now on both derelict gear removal and enforcement in collaboration with the Mexican Navy. So really, if anyone wants to get involved, it's really through supporting the efforts of any of those organizations. The ex situ effort is being led by the National Marine Mammal Foundation, and they also have a website and are accepting donations for that project. So people can support any of those efforts, the Sea Shepherd Conservation, Viva Vaquita, the Mammal Center's Vaquita Fund, National Mammal Foundation. Those are all ways to become involved.
Well, I would like to thank you for coming on our show today. It's nice that you shed some light on the issue. There's a lot of unknowns out there, especially when I'm trying to piece this stuff together. So you've definitely helped me understand a little bit more about this. Of course, there's still a lot more digging to do. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll watch very closely and see what ends up happening. So mm-hmm. Thank you, Francis, for coming on our show. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
All right, that was EOC producer Sean Bogle's conversation with Dr. Francis Gulland, vaquita expert and senior scientist at the Marine Mammal Center. As difficult as it is to hear about how dire the situation is for the vaquita, there is a glimmer of hope in this story. With the failure of Mexico's gillnet ban to have any positive impact on the vaquita population, the International Committee for the Recovery of the Vaquita has finally recognized that attempting to place animals in a captive setting is the only remaining option for the species. This remains extremely controversial, and you'll notice how defensive Dr. Gulland got in that interview when Sean used the words captive breeding. But to me, this indicates that it is not time to give up hope. Wildlands' very first project was the documentary Scavenger Hunt about the recovery of the California condor, and the parallels between these two conservation efforts are striking. The vaquita population is now at just about the same point that the California condor population reached in the early 1980s, at which time a similar decision was made to bring animals into captivity and launch a captive breeding program. This was extremely controversial when implemented for California condor population, just as it will be for the vaquita, but we know that it worked for the condor. Obviously, there are many differences between these two situations, but I maintain that if it was possible to save the condor, it must be possible to save the vaquita. If you'd like to learn more about vaquita conservation and the work being done by Dr. Gulland and her peers, we'll have additional information on the show notes page for this episode, which you can find at wildlensinc.org/EOC109. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. And if you really feel like being generous, you can leave us an honest rating and review on iTunes. Just search for Eyes on Conservation in the iTunes store or follow the link on the show notes page. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is a production of Wild Lens. Today's episode was produced by myself, your host Matt Podolsky, along with EOC producer and contributor Sean Bogle. Our theme music is by The Humidors.